city shines like a million pieces of glass. Made some mistakes, but you just throw your head back and laugh. Cigarette smoke still on my clothes. What do you think about me now?
Hey friends, welcome to the Recovering Artist Podcast, healing and recovery in the performing arts. My name's Dean Anthony, and it's great to have you with us. You know, the gift of recovery is one that grows with giving. Unless you give it away, we won't keep it. By sharing our recovery, our healing, and most important, our struggles with others, we tend to value that recovery even more. For me, only in my first year of recovery, it's been the most powerful and humbling year of my life. I have much to learn and much to discover, but I'm willing. In the months ahead, we'll have guests from all aspects of the performing arts industry discussing addiction, depression, anxiety, PTSD, sexual assault, food disorders, discrimination, and of course, sobriety. We're not professionals here at the Recovering Artist Podcast, and we are not affiliated or connected with any 12-step organization. We will have counselors and specialists joining us from time to time, but mostly, it's a platform for the performing artist community to truly have a voice. This is the reason for this podcast. You can find us on Facebook at the Recovering Artist Podcast for upcoming guests and ways to find us on your favorite listening platform. You can also leave us a review, ask questions, make suggestions, or just reach out. We'd love to hear from you. Lastly, a word of caution. This podcast may contain mature content, difficult subject matter, and strong language. Listener discretion is advised. The Recovering Artist Podcast is on now. Hey, my friends. Happy Wednesday. And it's great to be back with you for episode 12 here at the Recovering Artist Podcast. Yes, I did. I took a week off. Seems I needed it, and I needed a little break. So I took it. In the past, it was always really difficult for me to take a break, no matter what I was doing. You wonder why that is? Well, I didn't know how to slow down. There was that constant internal turmoil that lived inside of me. I was anxious, fearful, edgy, easily resentful, tense, and I was just ready to snap. That community in my head, as I always talk about, was constantly spinning. Then in my progression, just about everything in my life started spinning out of control. Now, at least for today, I'm just trying to live in that quiet place. Do the best I can just to accept what, where, and who I am, just in the moment. Do the next right thing. Don't make it worse. And if it works today, try again tomorrow. Just keeping it simple. Which brings me to the title of today's episode, So Many Choices. Sure, it's a broad topic, but with all these choices that we all have to make 100 times a day, I thought it would be good and cool to spend a cast on this. So I found a poem by an unknown author the other day and thought it was fitting. Now it's short, so just hang in there with me. I choose to live by choice, not by chance, to be motivated, not manipulated, to be useful, not used, to make changes, not excuses, to excel, not compete. I choose self-esteem, not self-pity. I choose to listen to my inner voice. I choose not to listen to the random opinions of others. I gotta say, I like these choices. So my guest today is Josh Ferrier. He's a singer, voice teacher, new friend, and all-around pretty cool guy. He's originally from a small town in central Illinois and spent much of his youth playing piano and organ. When he was 18, during his senior year in high school, he was a Rotary exchange student, which enabled him to study with the great Belgian bass Jules Bastien at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Brussels. He returned back to the States to study voice at the Cleland Institute, then at University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he got his doctorate from the University of Kansas, studying with one of my favorite people of all time, Joyce Castle. In 2003, he went to Germany for a Fest contract, which is a full-time position or house singer in Pforzheim. He was also Fest in Nordhausen. He was a guest artist in many other European theaters over his 17 years in Europe, singing roles such as Lenski in Eugene Onegin, Tamino in The Magic Flute, Eric in The Flying Dutchman, and Peter Grimes. He's also a passionate voice teacher for over 20 years, and now developing a teaching philosophy which links singing and spirituality as a means for finding one's authentic voice. He's interested in working with singers who have experienced vocal trauma and seek rehabilitation and rejuvenation. I'm looking forward to our conversation today. So with that, I give you Joshua. How are you today, my friend?
I'm doing okay. Great. I can't complain.
Good. It's so great to see you and have you on the cast this week. You know, I think it's pretty cool that we just actually met in person last week. We got to sit down and have lunch together, but we've been corresponding for a year or so since you got back to the States. But obviously, COVID and quarantine, I think it's wacky that you're only 30, 35 minutes away from me. And it took a year and what, a half for us to actually meet face to face.
Slow motion. Everything's in slow motion.
Exactly. And it was so cool too, because we sat down to have lunch and my gosh, I think we could have sat there for hours, couldn't we?
We did. Sat there for longer. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a big part of just our lives and our paths. And it's easy to talk to people and it's important to talk to people. So, you know, today we're, you know, I like to pick a topic. I'm a theme kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So many choices. And so, you know, you've had to make lots of choices in your life. Yes.
Sure.
Yeah. So why don't you give us a little bit of your story, or as they say in the program, your experience, strength, and hope.
Yoo-hoo.
Yes.
Raise the roof. And you all can't see me, but I'm literally raising the roof.
Good. But, you know, and your experience, strength, and hope around some of your choices. You know, I think this is a really interesting topic for us to dive in on. And I think we'll refer back to our lunch conversation quite a bit, even though our guests weren't with us. They could have been. So tell me some scoop, my friend. I look forward to hearing
some scoop. Well, first of all, I always take a double scoop, and I really like pralines and cream. And you can just go ahead and judge me on how I said pralines from the very beginning, whoever you are. So choices. I think it's interesting, you know, to being asked to be on a program like this is a great moment for some reflection on your own life. And I think the secret sauce that they're always talking about is actually persistence. And those involve choices too, because as an artist, as a young person struggling because you're different in whatever way you may be different. I grew up in the middle of nowhere in Illinois. So, you know, growing up just a gay man, but also somebody who had completely different interests than everybody around me.
Right.
Whenever you live your life, you really have to be persistent and insistent about the things that you love and the things that you want to do, because you're going to hear no all the time.
Right.
And, or no, you can't, or no, you shouldn't. Or one of the big things in rural society is who do you think you are? So, you know, I was growing up, the nearest town was, about 15 minutes away and had 1,000 people in it. So that's, you know, it's really rural in the middle of the state there.
Right.
I, I loved, my favorite program on TV was The Avengers, that old 60s one from that they'd show on PBS.
Oh my gosh, you know? Really?
Yeah. I wanted a bowler and an umbrella. Nice. And I wanted to, I was a total Anglophile, just a weird kid, I was obsessed with classical music. You know, when I was four, we had one of those Fisher Price record players.
Sure. Like
heavy plastic, white and orange. Yeah. And we had a stack of records, Winnie the Pooh or whatever. And then there were two records that were classical ones. And I just played them over and over and over and over. And my parents didn't. My parents are both not college educated people and don't have any musical background. And so here was this kid. I have a lot of sympathy for them. Here was this kid, and it's like, what alien planet did this kid come from exactly? He's super interested in Knights of the Round Table, loves all these English things, classical music. It's kind of, super nerdy. Uh-huh. What are we going to do with him? We don't know what to do with him. So
let me jump in for a second, but did you want to, did the idea of wanting it to escape that environment, was that a part of your, life too, as far as fantasizing about different worlds, different places, and feeling, as you said, kind of unique in your own way and not maybe being like everybody else? So that escapism can lead to lots of different things in people's choices as well.
In that sense, when I was young and the sort of taste choices, like what did I find funny? What was I drawn to? I would say the thing that you're talking about probably came later when I was a teenager, when you have that teenage angst anyway, and everybody has the 13-year-old child fantasy that they were switched at birth because their parents cannot possibly be their real parents. I mean,
right.
And this little Lord Fauntleroy kind of like, surely I am the King of England and nobody has realized it yet. there was an escapism. And that is to say, a need for escape. I actually finished high school in 3 years so that I could become a Rotary exchange student and go to Belgium for a year. Wow. And of course I was interested. I mean, I really wanted to go to learn French. And I really wanted to go because when I was in high school, all the exchange students were my friends. I mean, anybody that was different, I was like, oh, there's this, tell me all about Germany. I've got to know, right. And so I became an exchange student. It was also a way though of escaping. And so I did escape. I escaped for a year and was in Brussels, Belgium. It was there that, if you think about that, that's also a choice. It does take, when you're 18 or 17 or whatever, it takes balls to say, okay, I'm actually just going to get on a plane and go live with people I've never met. I'm going to stay there for a whole year. It's not even my language, Belgium, being Belgium, I stayed 6 months with a Flemish speaking family and 6 months with a French speaking family. Wow. So it's, and the other thing is about the Rotary is, I grew up not a kid of means, we weren't poor per se, but we were, I would say somewhere between lower middle class and middle class, if there is such a thing. So
I got to tell you that I couldn't have even fantasized about what you've just experienced when I was in high school. There's just no way that was even a part of my existence about going to a foreign country. And but I think there was too much fear inside. But I didn't have I don't think I wasn't that smart, it's pretty impressive to put yourself in that age and just say, hey, let's do this. It's easier to look back now and reflect on people who did that I knew, that I would probably just sit back and, like you called yourself a nerd, and said, well, they were a nerd and I was a jock and they were a freak and those horrible things that we categorize everybody in. But continue.
Yeah, no, the funny thing is I part of being in the program is also the inevitable fact that your ego it shrinks and shrinks. So I thank you for saying it was courage. But, you know, I think that courage was extremely bolstered by need, you know, to get the hell out of Dodge.
Gotcha.
They didn't like me. I mean, my parents loved me, of course, but my society didn't like me. I was not a huge fan of them. So, you know, I was gone. And in that year, there were a lot of you know, very formative things going on. The Rotary found out I could sing. So they ended up, you know, that was really just a crazy thing. You know, the Rotarians, they're in Europe, especially here, not so much in America, but to some extent here, but definitely in Europe. It's a very elite organization. And they're the cream of the cream, the creme de la creme.
Right.
And so when I went, it was not just an exchange into a different country or different languages. It was also an exchange of social echelon, you know, where, you know, I needed to learn how to eat properly and behave. And, you know, that was, you know, and being a classical musician as we are, we deal with rich people all the time. If you don't, if you don't learn how to deal with the wealthy folks, either the other students who are sent to conservatory and bringing their $50,000 violins, or with the donors, you're going to be SOL at some point.
Well, just hearing you say that cracks me up because, you know, I remember that, you know, when I had to learn how to, I'm supposed to turn my fork over and use it in that hand and take the knife in this hand. Oh, really? Okay. Well, because I didn't come from that kind of background either.
Yeah.
So, and how many glasses are there? How many forks, spoons, all that stuff that, you know, I mean, I still love it. I still find it so fascinating when I talk to people in this industry, or my favorite expression is soprano Brenda Harris, who's just a dynamo. I don't know if you know her or not, but, you know, she was raised on a pig farm. You know, you get that's just so amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
I went off topic.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. It's okay. You know, I think it's so funny because the Rotary would take us on these trips to, and we'd be eating in chateaus and having these, you know, 4-hour-long, 15-course meals and all this stuff, you know, that we didn't know anything about, you know.
Right.
You learn, when you're exchange student, the most important thing you learn is to smile and say yes, even if you don't understand what they're saying, right? So to be cordial and put off the right kind of vibe and to be nice. But also just to, you know, learn the rules and follow the rules. That's one thing about you give yourself away in so many different ways, in society. And one of the ways is, you know, can you pass, I guess is how we would say it in other ways in our lives. But, I always remember one of the Rotarians was watching me eat in one of these chateaus and said, "Il mange bien." And I was like, "Oh wow, what a great compliment! He eats well."
Nice.
You know, I'm like, "Cool." Right. You know, that's so. Some of these things for an 18-year-old kid are make a big difference. But anyways,
it's a validation that you're getting in Belgium that you weren't getting in this rural place in Illinois.
True, that too. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, they didn't care about stuff like that. I mean, the priorities are all different, and it's important for me to. And I would say this to all my friends who, you know, I have a lot of people come to me for advice for some reason. And one of the things I would say to them is, you know, don't invalidate your past and don't invalidate the characters in your past by saying, "Oh, well, they didn't care about that because they were dumb." No, there were different priorities.
Sure.
Why in the world would a farm wife who's got a short haircut just because it's practical be worried about what fork to use? It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So anyway, so it was in that year being abroad that the Rotarians were like, you know, "Oh, well, you know, this kid has a really nice voice. And, oh, well, there's another Rotarian who's a conductor. We should have him sing for this conductor and see what the conductor says." So they would come to the house and, you know, their long line of black BMWs to pick me up, to take me to sing for this conductor. And the conductor was like, "Oh, that's a good voice. Yeah, he should really sing for Jules Bastin." And Jules Bastin, José Van Damme and Jules Bastin were always the famous Belgian opera singers at the time.
Right.
And Jules Bastin is the one that sings on that famous Kiri Takanawak recording with of Così Fan Tutte.
Right.
He's the bass. He's gotcha. The Alfonso in that recording. So you know, different time period, of course. Sure. People probably don't know him now, I guess. But so then again, they went on a different day. They all sort of come with their black BMWs to pick me up and to take me to perform for this famous, you know, opera singer. And then I sing for him and he says, well, you know, I can't imitate his voice because his voice was so bass and sonorous. But he's like, oh, it would be a shame to waste a voice like this. You know, so they arranged it that even though I was supposed to go to a high school, that I would actually start studying at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Brussels with Jules Bastin.
Wow.
And, you know, I think there was a lot of behind the scenes patting on the back and favors asked because, you know, I didn't know anything about music. I mean, right. I had been taking piano since I was a kid and I had taken some voice lessons. Yeah. I mean, but you know, they're like, okay, now, you know, you need to take some lesson or you needed to take some exams in order to get into the conservatory. And then they sent me in. They're just like, okay, now go take this exam. And I walked in, it was, you know, a concert hall filled with a whole bunch of students. And, you know, of course, being exchange student, the first thing I do is find a seat and then start looking around to see what is going on here. And everybody's got staff paper and they're waiting, you know, for somebody to come out onto the stage because there's a big piano there. So I go up to a friend. I'm like, not a friend, some stranger. Yeah. Can I borrow some staff paper? So I borrowed some staff paper. This guy comes out. He says, okay, now notate this, and starts playing stuff on the piano. You know, I'm just this 18-year-old kid, right? Who took piano lessons from the neighbor lady. I don't,
right.
So somehow, and that's what I mean by there was probably some favors done to even get me in, because I can't imagine that that my, like, you know, exam went off very well. Anyway, so I studied that year as a sort of college student and that was a really big formative year because we did concerts with Jules Bastin and it was cool to see and to sort of rub elbows with somebody like that. And
especially the other reason. At 18.
Yeah. And the other thing that was important about that year was that my one friend, Simon, who's still my friend, a British guy studying at the Royal Conservatory, befriended me. You know, when you're over there and it's all and all the Flemish, you know, it's like you meet somebody who's British and it's like latch on, you know. Right. And he is a really cool guy. And I went over, he's like invited me to his house. And, you know, we're sitting on the couch and he's like, and I realized there's only one bedroom, you know, and I know he has a roommate that's a guy and there's only one bed. And I'm like, wait a second. So then I'm like, hey, yeah, you have a roommate and there's only one bed. Oh yeah, I'm gay. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I'm cool with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Simon was the first guy that I ever told that it ever came out of my mouth. I remember in my mind, the exact place that this happened when I said, you know, Simon, I think I'm gay too.
Wow.
And literally, I mean, you know, it's like an Ally McBeal scene, you know, in my mind, the heavens opened up, you know, right. And all the weight came, and, like, you know how they say that? Literally, I felt weight came off my shoulders.
Well, of course.
So that was, you know, the choices to do that kind of stuff and put yourself out there. What I always did was I would do a conscious choice and then push my back up against the wall, because I'm actually a lot more timid. Mm. And, you know, I'm always teasing people and saying I'm actually really kind of mildly agoraphobic. You know, if I have to come out, it's usually to get food, but, you know, I think those choices to do those things were me forcing myself to do them. And that happens a lot in life for me.
You know, one of the things that, I'm not going to say triggered, but something that just came into my mind listening to you say that, you know, I remember that, I'm not going to go into my whole thing, but I remember that first time I sang in Europe. In that feeling when I was in Berlin, and I was over there for a lengthy period of time, and just that, as I call it, the pond, the life between the ponds, it felt like a magic world. Like everything I do over here is going to stay over here. You know what I mean?
It's the ultimate Las Vegas.
Exactly. That's another story. What stays in Vegas stays in Vegas. But, you know, so everything that happens over here is in its own world. And then when I go back, yeah, I'll deal with that later. That's just different.
Right.
So that's a whole other topic, my friend. I can imagine us going there at some point.
Yeah. There's a weird thing. And as far as I can tell, it's a phenomenon that hasn't been greatly improved by the fact that we have communication of all sorts. Europe is this sort of thing that happens over there, and they feel the same way. I mean, I came over, I'm jumping ahead in the story, but when I went to Europe to do my audition tour, they didn't give a crap about any of the festivals I'd done or, you know, because I went to Brevard two different summers.
You mean over here?
They didn't care. Right. You know, as far as they were concerned, it could either be legitimate or it could all be a lie. You know, they knew. Yeah.
And the last thing they're going to do is just go research Brevard Music Center or something. You know, they don't care. I get it.
Yeah. It's weird. So anyway, so that year was really important. I came back to the States and I got a
this is the part that I'm interested about, how it was for you to come back and then, you know, put your feet back on this ground compared to that ground.
Well, I mean, what I'm realizing, you know, in my counseling, I'm gonna a lot of this interview is gonna show vulnerability, just because I read enough Brene Brown to know that vulnerability is actually strength. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Burn. So I like, you know, I do a lot of compartmentalization in my brain, or have, in order to survive in the past.
Right.
And to me, it was sort of like, you know, Europe, there's that thing and that experience, and America is that thing and that experience. But I don't, at least now, maybe I'm rewriting history, but I don't spend a lot of time thinking about how they're different, and God, not at all about what's better, because that's just a bunch of BS beyond belief.
Right.
And, you know, we as Americans, don't even get me started on that, because, you know, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't in the world, right? Mm. Of course, we're not saints, right? But but the constant criticism of everything we do is just so apparent when you are an American living abroad for 17 years. It's not, you know, how would I say that? It's not terrible or anything, but, you know, I was over there when Obama was elected. I was over there when Trump was elected.
Right.
And, you could just as well have been in America, because it's palpable how much they hated Trump. But, you know, so I guess what I'm saying is that that's one experience. And here's another experience to come back over after being abroad for a year. You know, for one thing, I needed to take a shower much more regularly. That's nice. The one comment I get from my friends and parents who picked me up from the airport when I came back was, God, you stink. Other than that, you know, I was going off to a new life anyway. I went to the University of Illinois for a year and studied there, and then transferred to the Cleveland Institute of Music, where I finished my undergraduate. And there's, you know, lots of other stuff to do. Sure. I wasn't equating it to the life that I'd had in the country, because that life was sort of over.
But you obviously somehow, while you were over in Europe, made a conscious decision that I would like to go into music, and this is the path that I'm going to take, right?
Okay, so, you know, I always wanted to be a church organist. That's what I wanted the most. And, you know, what's so funny is that, you know, even after having had a having had and still having, I'm always make sure to still say that I'm still having a career. It's not my fault COVID happened. Anyway, so even today when I meet people who are like have a cushy organ job and they have right. a cool organ to play and they've got, I'm like, I'm actually jealous. I'm like, that's what I always really wanted. Because everyone sort of assumes that I'm this huge extrovert, you know, and actually right. I just want to like, you know, get up every day. It's like Jiro Makes Sushi. Did you ever see that movie?
No, I didn't.
You didn't, you need to, because okay. especially you, that's an awesome movie. Oh my God. Anyway, I'd like to get up every day, exact same time and get my shower and put on my shoes and walk to the church and do my practice, right. you know. That's the life I was wanting, but I was not good. That's the problem. I'm like now I'm good enough to play for my students, but I was never really a good enough organist to have made a career at it.
Right.
So what I was getting was, well, but you have a nice voice. And I was like, I knew I wanted music because I love music. I mean, right. love music. So I knew I wanted to do something in music and I had to pick whichever thing, you know, I also played the tuba, but I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't like, classic. I've got to be a tubist because, you right. know, it's, so I became a singer and actually that year abroad and studying with Drew Bastin was like the formative one saying, okay, yes, I can be a singer and I like right. being a singer. So coming back, that's where that already, that form of my identity took root, so to speak. And I became a singer.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's obviously that we could just, you know, as we know, our conversations could just go on and on and on about stuff, but I do want to, you know, dive into one of the things that I think our connection solidified pretty quickly was based on the fact that we're both in our own programs, you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that so much of already what you've said about your past and your youth and then into your year in abroad and then coming back and all those things, yeah, I just really am fascinated with how how each of our addictions are different,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
how they, in the 12-step scenario, it's easy to just bring it up for both of us at all times. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where is it
not applicable?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, because you're talking about the past, and all I'm thinking about is, you know, don't regret the past, you know, but don't mm-hmm. shut the door on it. Don't shut mm-hmm. the door on it. You know, so that's a part of the steps. And so let me know or tell me where your scenario came to a head for you in that.
Well,
if you will.
No problem. My policy has always been I'm not clever enough to keep all the lies straight. So I'm just kind of like an open
book. Nice. Same here.
You know, my issue is eating. So, and I always knew it was a problem because I was always heavy. I mean, it's one of those things where it's hard to deny. You've got a mirror, you know. I was talking to another big friend of mine and she's like, I own my fatness, you know? And I'm like, well, I mean, I don't know about owning mine, but you know, when people make a comment about my weight, I'm like, you know, I do have a mirror at home. I know what I look like. Thank you though for the information since it was so heartfelt. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it was obvious that I had a problem, and whenever it comes to, eating and being big, you know, you always know that it's a problem, but you don't necessarily associate the fact that it's an addiction.
Right.
And, you know, and we're also, you know, perhaps we would now, because, you know, just about everybody's seen at least one episode of My 600-Pound Life. I mean, if you don't know it's an addiction after seeing that show, then you are going to have to, I don't know, learn it in Braille or something. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, I mean, I think what I've noticed in that kind of processing, and when I watch things now, even in my early recovery, watch documentaries about something such as that or another addiction or, excuse me, even watching Hoarders or something like that.
Gosh. Yeah.
You know, I'm watching it through different eyes now.
Yeah.
I'm completely watching it through different eyes now. There's a different sense of compassion for sure.
Yeah.
And understanding and hope. I don't know, hope or just yeah. comfort. Yeah. You know, what I wish for anyone struggling in any form of addiction is comfort, you know, or peace. Something that I had no way to process, you know, a year and a half ago. Just impossible yeah. because of that ego and because of all that other stuff that gets in the way. So continue, my friend.
And habit. And
well, habit's this
is,
huge.
You know, this is my existence. This is my sense of self because this is what I do and this is how I deal with my situations. You know, and I'm not clear on the whole, that aspect of anonymity with 12 steps, but do I get to mention what my program is? I don't really ever really know.
Well, yeah, sure. You can mention it. I mean, I think the key to what we're doing now is we're just being open and discussing right. this for others to help. But, you know, the programs themselves, the people in it are anonymous, right. but the programs sure. are not. So.
Right. So, you know, I'm in OA, which is Overeaters Anonymous. Mm. And, you know, I watched an interesting TikTok the other day. Now I'm outing myself as, you know, one of those people. But the woman's like, she'd lost 300 pounds, I think. Right. And she's like, you know, when you're looking back and looking at how you ate in order to cope, don't judge yourself because now you have the tools to do something with your emotions other than eat them. And that's great. But don't look back and say you should have known. Right. You didn't know. You were trying to survive and you did survive. And I found very interesting perspective on it because it's just about, and it also reinforces for the individual, this is why this came about. You know, and you know, this is all over the place, I know, and that's just how it is when it goes to these kind of conversations. But sure. Right now, what I'm realizing, because in OA, abstinence is considered being free from eating compulsively.
Right.
And so, and
you it's, also have it, to eat. You have to eat to live. I mean, that's
yeah. It's, you know, it's a weird, it's of the different 12 steps, you know,
sure.
it, you know, I don't want to say, cause I've never been in AA or NA or any of the other A's.
Sure.
And I don't, and it's not cool to say it's that, oh, well, OA is, you know, it's harder. It's not the point, but, I can say that in my group, I have had people who I've already gone through other 12 step programs and landed there and got stuck on the OA.
Well, yeah. And that's because once, for me, I'll just say quickly, you know, the fact that I understand that, and I've said this on this cast many times, is that I innately am a holic.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, it's workaholic,
yep.
alcoholic, you know, obviously I think there's a foodaholic. I mean, because,
sure.
you know, I have gone through many incantations of my own person. We were talking about this yesterday. I mean, the fact that at one period of my life, I just said, that's it. And I dropped 80 pounds in 5 months or something like that. And got
yeah,
back.
Yeah, don't
and,
brag.
I'm sorry. Got to the gym. And, I was, and then I started doing the tumbles and all that physical stuff. And I was basically, for a big chunk of my career, you know, in really great shape. And then,
right.
but that created its own massive pressure that I wasn't even aware of, especially in my own
right.
head. In my
yeah.
own head.
You know, in my teaching, I'm always talking about how, you know, for instance, if a student, and this is very typical, when they have way too much laryngeal, not pressure, but, what's it called? I'm always doing these when it comes to teaching. I have to translate a lot because I still teach my German students yes. in German. Yeah. Spannung is the word I'm thinking. So that's okay. more like tension. So
right.
When a kid has too much laryngeal tension, My way of explaining that, or any other kind of tension, is tension's energy. It just happens to be the wrong kind. It right. needs to be transformed and into a different kind of energy. And this right. needs to be an energy that has movement, and it needs to be an energy that does. It's like a. It's like comparing a swimmer's body to a weightlifter's body. You know,
sure. right.
they're both muscular, but one of them also has a lot of flexibility.
Right.
So in this case, you know, we're talking about just changing an energy into one thing or another. In what you were talking about being a holic, if you don't actually go through the steps and work at the reasons that it came, you can right. just change from one holic to being another holic.
Exactly.
If no you question. Want.
Yeah.
You know?
Without even yeah. thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know?
And
you talked about abstinence. And that's just, you know, I had someone on a couple, you know, months ago that was had lost a great deal of weight and had was in her own program, not like mm-hmm. ours, but you know, it was really fascinating to talk to her about that. And but again, this conversation is still so fascinating to talk to you mm-hmm. about OA versus AA or whatever. Is that mm-hmm. Abstinence is it for me.
Mm.
That's it. I mean,
yeah.
I am not drinking. You know, I'm doing yeah. my best today, working on my program. But you got to eat.
Yeah.
To live.
What's so cool about saying it's okay. It's wonderful to be able to say, I was abstinent today. I didn't have a drop. And
right.
with a definition of abstinence, even already being somewhat fluffy, is the you know, not eating compulsively.
Right.
Where's that line? So that's always a big subject, because you know, in our case, in OA, abstinence is something that's decided on by an individual and their sponsor together.
Mm.
A lot of times it's like, just eat three meals a day. That's where we're going to start. That's where right. your abstinence is. It can go from every iteration from that to this, I only eat this number of calories a day, or there's so many different ways to do it. There are a lot of people in program that are sugar and refined flour addicts. So
right.
that's a part of their abstinence. So, and then for us, there's a difference between being abstinent and following your food plan.
Mm.
So it's a very zany. Sure. I mean, I'm going to say, use that word.
Zany?
Zany. It's zany, well,
you
man.
You also just said the word fluffy about 3 minutes ago, too. So
right.
Bring it on, man. I love all those.
But, you know, whenever you're thinking about abstinence, it's important for me at the end of the day to know that I've been absent, right?
Mm.
Well, and in other programs, that's the abstinence is the thing. And for us, it is too, but it's also expected in OA that there will be a physical recovery at some point.
Mm.
In other words, it's not a diet, but it's expected that you'll lose weight. And I haven't really, you know, people are like, so you've been in OA for how long and you're still big? And I'm like, yeah, dude, but you have no idea how big I would have been.
Ah, gotcha.
If you've ever seen 600 Pound Life, not to bring that up again, but, and you look at these right. people's histories, you know, how many of them, it's literally the first program I've ever seen in my life where I've actually heard the word gang rape used on several different episodes.
Hmm.
So people are raped, gang raped, even experience intense trauma, and then end up 600 pounds. It's not hard to connect those dots, right?
Right.
So,
trauma is the key word that you
trauma, yeah. trauma, yeah. yeah. And the funny thing is, so I guess the point that I'm going to is, I have the most awesome sponsor, because I didn't know if you knew this, but between 1 and 2 out of 100 people, that's 1% to 2% of people who are obese can lose anything more than 10% of their weight and keep it off.
Hmm.
If there were a drug that worked 1% of the time, it would be, you know,
yeah.
What can you even call that? It's not even a drug,
right.
you know? So, that's what you're sort of up against whenever it comes to this stuff. And I remember at the time I was in Europe, because that's a whole different story. Mm. I didn't know if I wanted to continue singing. So I was talking to a life coach, and, you know, she brought up my weight, which I'm like, oh, great. I'm going to talk about my weight, my favorite subject. Mm. It's not my favorite subject, by the way, in case anybody didn't catch that.
Sorry, like, I had to bring it up. That's what this cast is for, my brother.
right? Yeah. It's audio only, so, you know.
True.
So she's like, you know, I was telling her this thing about the statistics. And she's like, well, that's interesting, because I actually know somebody who is one of the 1%. Hmm. And she lost a whole bunch of weight. You know, I think over 100 pounds, and she's kept it off the entire time through OA. And I had already known about OA, but I wasn't really involved in OA.
Right.
And so I was like, okay. And so now that woman is my sponsor. The beauty of Zoom and the beauty of, you know, Skype or whatever. She lives in California. I've never met her in person.
Really? Okay.
And she's been my sponsor for, I think, 2.5 years.
Wow.
And the point of the story, still haven't gotten there. Isn't it amazing? You know, isn't it amazing how long the stories are? The point is that this year, and literally, I mean, in 2021, she finally started pushing up and saying, okay, you have experienced recovery because you are not eating compulsively, and you have had recovery for a while, and your weight has remained the same. Mm. We need to start thinking about your physical recovery. And my first thing was, can we cuss on this program?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
That sounded like an invitation. Like, if I start, you can start. So she was like, we need to start talking about your physical recovery. And I'm like, fuck no.
Right.
And the reason being, every single time I've tried to lose weight was full of pain. So much pain.
Right.
So much lack of success. So much. And of course, you know, back then it was all on me, right?
Right.
That's the thing. You've got an addict, and then you're telling him that his recovery is all on him. There's no step one.
Right. Yeah. Well, so that's what conversation, my brain just keeps going back to, you know, using these tools that we're trying to find, but how different they are solely based on what we're dealing with. I mean, if we're just looking, you and me are having a chat today, it's alcohol and food. They just are different.
Yeah.
And then society's opinion on all of it. That pressure is a whole nother topic. You know, and that's going back to America. I mean, that's one of the biggest things we deal with, is just, you know, people who judge. I mean, that word judgment, you know?
I mean, so, I have to say that I don't experience that very much. I'm 6'2".
Yeah.
I'm built like a linebacker.
Right.
You know, I've got a belly. And I'm obviously, you know, I'm overweight. But I would always get this, oh, you're not fat. You're fat, but, you know, you're just a big guy, you know. And there is that's a sort of shadow that I stand in, or an umbrella I stand under, that my sisters in the program definitely have a different experience, you know. Mm-hmm. Who's going to come up to the 6'2" guy who looks like he could, you know, with one hand kick your ass and tell him he's fat? Probably not. And it doesn't, this doesn't happen.
Right,
I'm telling you, you know, we talk about privilege of all different kinds. I've got big guy privilege.
Gotcha.
No one messes with me. I wasn't bullied when I was a kid. I was always bigger than everybody else.
Right.
You know, I kicked the shit out of somebody in high school in front of everybody else. Mm-hmm. And that showed everybody, okay, well, and this also is a privilege that allowed me to develop as I felt I wanted to, or whatever.
Sure.
So getting back to the whole, you know, physical recovery thing, from the society, there's not a lot of problem. You know, my husband loves me the way I am. And, you know, I don't have I'm one of those weird, and that's going to, you know, people are probably going to write in about this comment, but one of those healthy fat people where like I have good blood pressure. I don't have any sugar problems. Sure. I'm not pre-diabetic. My pulse is 77. I don't, you know, I don't have a lot of mobility issue. Well, hardly any mobility issues. You know, I don't have, I just don't have problems like that. I don't have, I have no, well, almost no cholesterol problems. I have triglycerides or, but anyway, so she's like, you need to lose weight. And I'm like, well, I've got money. I've got a husband. I've got a career. I've got everything. Why is it that I need to lose weight exactly? But I did come around, and so I started losing weight. And then I would get on the scale and it would say something that was obviously, you know, great. Or then I would go look at the mirror and I looked a lot different. Scared the crap out of me.
Interesting.
Scared the absolute crap out of me, and I gained weight immediately.
Wow.
So I did this about, you know, and not just yo-yo as in the old way before program, but yo-yoing in program. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to see a counselor.
Interesting.
I have to see a counselor. And I knew that this thing was actually because it had something to do with my sexuality.
Okay.
Now, I guess I should preface this by saying I'm 48, and my story that I always told to people, which is, you know, literally makes people laugh now, but I was serious. I'd be like, yeah, I was gay. I grew up in a fundamentalist household in the country, and I had no problem with it. And now I'm seeing a counselor, and I realize that I was growing up being, you know, it was very clear what homosexuals were and where they were going, you know?
Right.
And literally, and I was like card carrying, man. I was into it. I was very religious.
Yeah. You know? Well, that was a talking point that we were going to jump into later. So we might as well go in there now.
Because
I know that we were both somewhat raised in that semi-evangelical aspect of our worlds, and I don't think I ever was a card carrying. I might have had a separate card just to get away with things, if that makes sense. But you know, you said to me, and I think it was really fascinating the way you said it to me, which you said, you know, I was an evangelical, then I became an atheist, then I went and started working back toward a spirituality thing, and then now you're in the, we'll get to it in a minute, but Buddhism and all that. I'm like, oh, great. Okay. Because, you know, talking about meditation, which you say you do every day, you know, I have too many squirrels in my head. You know, I'm constantly trying to learn how to meditate.
Yeah, we need to talk about that, but we'll leave that for off the air. You know, okay. I mean, you're not, you wouldn't be the first person with squirrels in his head who attained
or some enlightenment. Or what do I call it? I call it the community in my head.
That's community in my head. You know. That's great. That's great. I love that. That's good.
So
I relate.
Yeah. So let's make sure we get back to what you're talking about, which was
So you know, basically, so the point is, I in the present moment, I'm in counseling, and through counseling, and through meditation, and through my walk with God, and through the 12 steps, I have come to understand that, I was becoming inside of myself the worst possible thing that you could be. I was becoming the devil incarnate. And my way of dealing with that was, you know, lock it all up and put it on a shelf. It comes out when I'm like feeling super horny or something, and then I put it back. And then I'm just going to sort of deny that that's there, like literally. And, you know, my second grade teacher, Mrs. Polly, my favorite teacher, she said the biggest lie is the lie to yourself. And that I was experiencing the biggest lie, you know, which was put it on a shelf. And as you put it on the shelf, make a pact with yourself that you're going to try to forget that that's where you put it. And so I had this complete compartmentalization going, which is the only way that I could you know, I wasn't doing it consciously, but I'm going to assume from this viewpoint that that's what I could do to survive. But I wrote recently, you know, I write also, I'm a writer. I write missives for, you know, normally, not every day, but often, that I compile together into anthologies and whatnot. So, and I wrote about it the other day. I said, as that book of my, about my sexual desires really was being written, there was another book in another part of the library being written, and it was all about the shame that was accumulating, because I realized in some way or another that I was becoming something that we all agreed we hated. Not because some demon entered my body, not because I was a blasphemous person, not because of all the things that they preach, just because. And that book of shame, that is, you know, this huge Gutenberg Bible on some shelf in the which has been hidden from me at 48 years old. I've only just now discovered that it exists.
Well, you know that, but you know that's the thing. I mean, you use that whole expression you just talked about just so made sense to me, because you're 48, I'm almost 58. And that whole sense of shame from those first 47 years, you know, they're just, that was a big, big hill to I'm not going to say conquer. It's a big hill to climb. And I'm going to be on that climb for as long as I can. It's not, I'm never going to get there and shove a flag at the top of the hill and say, ta-da, it's just not going to happen. And that grace that we're able to find a way to give to ourselves is key for me, and I'll speak for myself. But you know, to give yourself the grace to understand that, you know, I did what I did, I went where I went, you know, as long as I'm, you know, I now try to pause and process, and that's the thing, because you know, you're talking about those boxes, that shoving that boxes. I have the same thing, Joshua. I have the same exact thing, and just different things in different boxes.
Yeah.
And different books.
And, you know, so the current theory is, you know, my counselor says, so you were growing up, you were accumulating this intense shame about your sexuality. You didn't want to become these homosexuals that you saw on TV. And in order to make yourself not that, you made yourself as asexual as you could by gaining weight and using food to actually remove yourself from the entire equation. You know, I don't need to tell anybody in the gay community that there's a, you know, being overweight is probably like the least desirable thing in the community. So somehow I was using weight to remove myself and in some way to almost like neuter myself from that. Right. That was, and I would hold that at bay with my weight. So I ended up being right. Of course, you know, I love being right. Right?
We all do.
That's the best. I was right.
Oh, come on. Any addict wants to be right. Hey, come on.
Yeah. The yo-yo was because of my sexuality, you know, and now it's like, you know, Brené Brown, shame. What are you going to do with shame? You have to bring shame, cannot live by the light of day. It when it's exposed, it dies. So that's all I'm thinking about right now. Yesterday, I literally woke up and decided I wanted to write a song cycle about my shame.
Wow.
The second song of which is a patter song, which is just a long list of all of the names I've been called in my life.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. You know, I just got to slip this in, and I don't know if it's off topic or not, but the beauty of this conversation that we're having here, and this, the beauty of meeting someone new in your life, through whatever journey you're on at that time. And I can honestly say this is that, you know, 2 years ago, Joshua, I never would have had this conversation with you. It's impossible. And so it's such a, gosh, I'm really, really grateful just to be able to be sitting here with you, because look, all of your things. And so here's the deal. I mean, I'm going to bring this up and it may just be wacky to people, but if we were in high school together at the same age, I would have been on that other group of people who were giving you shit, being in a different world. I did not have anything like the experience of going to Europe. And so how wacky and cool is that? That we're actually, I think we became almost instant friends once you walked in and we sat down at the table.
It's a bromance. It's the beginning of a bromance.
Bro, hey, bro. I use bro in that. Yeah, I love that. You know, so I think that that's really, it's really important. And, you know, the also the part of the programs that we deal with is that, you know, if I just sent you a text somewhere in a couple weeks and just said, hey, bro, you know, you got 5 minutes to chat, you would pick up the phone in a second.
Yeah.
And we would talk. Yeah. And
because we know as well what that means, well, right?
we also know that, you know, that you're supposed to. You know, and you know, when I asked you to join us today, and there was zero hesitation. no, which is great because
You invited me to come to a show to talk about my favorite subject, me.
You nice. Yes, exactly. That's hysterical. So yeah, and as again, we could probably end up talking for 6 hours, but we will lose listeners if that keeps going on.
Too bad for them, man. Too bad, yes. Taste.
So tell me about your choices and journey into some of the spirituality aspects that you are tap dancing on, since this is a podcast about performing arts. You know, the Buddhism and so fascinating that, you know, when you came over back from Germany, and we didn't get into your career stuff, which is fine.
Which is the biggest shame of all, because, like, obviously I'm awesome, but go on.
No, but, you know, you move, you and your partner moved back to the States, and now you are in this town. And I just think it's really fascinating who's across the street from you.
Oh, yeah, right.
I just love this.
It's so funny because when I first got here, okay, first of all, you know, my husband and I are Episcopalians, you know, my husband's German. Hmm. So, and he's classically German, you know, if you spoke to him, he has a nice German accent and, you know,
yes,
and is German in the other ways that we know Germans to be. But
following all the rules, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And so he was a senior art director in an agency, and he was a voluntary youth, you know, of the youth teacher, I guess you'd say, at our church. And at some point or another, he realized that he had received the call to be a youth minister. Hmm. And that was his calling. It came because when he was growing up, he was in a youth group in his town, and he ended up not, you know, believing at all. He ended up coming back to God because of our relationship. But that reference and that help that he had in that youth group when he was young is part of the call of why he is, you know, called to be a youth minister. And so he applied for a job, and he got a job here at St. James Episcopal in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And so the dialogue inside my head was always, we're moving back for Chris. Mm. You know, I've been wanting to come back for a while.
Right.
You know, but I wanted, you know, because I have a doctorate in voice, I wanted to be a professor.
Sure.
We always thought I would get a professorship and then we would move back, but he ended up getting the job.
Right. Back.
So there was this inner dialogue for me when we got here. And Hendersonville, by the way, just for anybody who's not from here, is a utopian place. It's like Brevard. It's beautiful.
Right.
It's, you know, this is where everybody comes to retire because the summers are not hot. And it's just a fantastic place. So So in the first months, of course, these were all the first COVID months, because right. we literally landed on the day before the shutdown.
Unbelievable.
The travel shutdown. We're here and I'm like, okay, we moved here for him. And I was going to come back and be like, okay, now I need to fly to New York and get an agent. I need to start doing auditions. I need to, you know, I'm going to start flying to New York and start a studio and teach. I really like to teach sure. professional singers the most, to be honest with you, especially ones who have problems. Come to me. If you're a professional singer and have problems, I can help you. But so we thought that that was the deal. Like, the reason we're here is because of you, but we didn't understand God, and we never do.
Right.
Because it wasn't just for him. Because little did I know that across the street is a Buddhist monastery. And of course, I still am a Christian. I mean, maybe people don't understand you can be Christian and Buddhist at the same time. So at the time and during the shutdown, it was all via Zoom anyway. So there was like no commitment on my part. I was like, I want to learn about the Dharma
right.
and actually learn. Because in Christianity, especially in more mainline, liberal, theologically driven churches, you know, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Unitarians, the Episcopals, the, you know, all these right, people right. Say that the next closest major world religion to Christianity is Buddhism. And I was like, that's, you know, and I am interested in Buddhism, so why don't I start learning about it? You know, I ain't got nothing better to do. Watch Netflix all day.
Right.
You know, you don't need to be telling a person who's in OA who has problems with their weight to sit on the couch all day
right,
and
right.
watch Netflix. I'm right. just telling you, you should. That's probably not right. a good thing. So I started watching these Dharma talks, and Venerable Panyawati, who is the head of the monastery there, she would speak about the Dharma. But they do it in such a way that it's not, and now there are the five these and the 10 these and the six, mm-hmm. you know, it can get really complicated with sure. all the different specifics, but their way of teaching it is very, very cool. So and this particular monastery is super interested in music and super interested in singing and cool. super interested in bringing the Dharma to people through music.
Great.
And so here I am a year later, and three of the monastics are my voice students.
Wow.
And I go over there on Tuesday and Thursday to watch the Dharma talk and then give them, and then they feed me lunch. And then they, you know, how it is in a monastery, right?
Well, yeah,
and
but
then
you I also get them, this to be in their presence. And,
right.
And
yeah.
How cool is that?
That's right. And then I give them their lessons, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, I spend a lot of time there. And obviously, I spend a lot of time in my own church, and actually in the Presbyterian church too, because that's where my gig is right now.
Gotcha.
And so there's this, along with the 12 steps, which is, you know, it's amazing. I'm very interested as a person with universalism anyway. I mean, right. I would much rather the professors in a voice committee in a university, I would much rather them focus on the things that they share in common than the things that are, but that's not how it ends up happening. It's right. like my cult of this teacher is the only one who knows anything about music or how to sing,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm always interested in universalism, and being there and understanding more about the Dharma has been really, really enriching. And I think it's only because of these, you know, how God works. Of course we don't, but
nope, but
his wisdom is beyond our understanding. But
right.
you think, why are you having me do this? Why are you having me do this? Until all of a sudden click, all the 15 different factors come together and you realize,
Oh,
I'm just a big dum-dum. And thank you, by the way, I would never have figured that out, but I'm here where I am cared for. I am here where I am nurtured at a time when I'm about to go through a tunnel, which is going to be one of the scariest tunnels I have ever gone through, involving my own shame, especially childhood shame about my own sexuality.
Right.
Because that wouldn't have happened
Right.
I mean, I'm not shallow or anything per se, but my back has to be pushed up against the wall to get things too. I can be a hard headed
sure
mofo.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but, I mean,
well, but yeah, I mean, I'm just going to go back to this whole thing, but you know, Joshua, this really feels like it feels like you've been given a gift.
For sure.
And you know, and the fact is that you didn't run away from it. You just kind of embraced it. So my simple brain, because obviously you're smart. I don't think of myself as smart. I think of myself.
Wow, we need to talk about that too.
But
anyway, we got a list of things to talk about.
Well, but you know, it's powerful. That's very, very cool. And so, well, you know what? We could actually talk for hours and hours and hours. But is there anything, any last closing thoughts? We didn't get to everything, but you know, maybe you can come back again down the road.
Yeah,
but,
I think the main thing, you know, if I were to think about, especially a younger person who is listening, the thing that I think about the most is, yes, you know, there are lots of, the Trevor Project will tell you it gets better. And yes, that's absolutely true. But it's very important to not accept no as an answer in your life. Persistence is the only key. I wasn't the most talented singer. I wasn't the most talented any number of things. But when I knew inside of myself, and that again is about being in touch with God and discerning what he wants and being willing to be cool with that. Right. Once you start going down that path, and when somebody says no, you know, you give them the finger in your mind, not in real life, and you walk away and you find a different way.
Right. I mean, but inside of that, if you just can muster up any form of humility in everything that you're doing, and you can, you look, I can't fix you. I can only take care of myself. So, but again, we know both of us and anyone in the performing arts is we picked the most difficult path when it comes to ego and self and all the above, but how to handle that with a sense of humility and grace and compassion. And you go, okay. I mean, that's been the biggest journey for me. And I say this all the time on here. I mean, thank God my obsession to drink is lifted. It's not gone. It's lifted. But, you know, so what do I deal with now? I deal with my emotional sobriety 24/7.
Yeah.
And so that comes from that person saying no to me, which you and I have talked, and we won't bring this up, but we were both just told no a couple of times. And a couple of things that we were seeking. And okay. All right. And how I would have dealt with it a year and a half ago versus the way I was able to deal with it today. That's a gift. I mean, that's where the gift comes so that I can go sit on my porch in peace and go, it's going to be okay. Yeah. It's all right. It's just,
you know, fine. I used to call it the, okay, there's no such thing as not falling off the horse. The question is, how long are you going to sit on the ground and whine before you pick yourself up, dust yourself off and try it again?
I was an acrobat. Long? So if I fell off, I would do a flip and I'd land on my feet, but that's just me. I'm kidding.
Wow. You're so cool. I almost forgot.
Oh, there goes the ego. No, I'm just, but I get it. You know, right. Pick yourself, dust yourself off and go back. I always use the adage when I talk to young singers, and this is even years ago, is that, you know, you just unzip your chest, open it up, puke it out, and then close your chest, zip it up, and put it away.
Yeah, that's cool. You know? I love that.
And just zip it up. And make sure you zip it up, and then you go. Or the other one was, you know, look, make it as simple as you're a fruit vendor.
Yeah.
Today I'm selling oranges. Okay, here are my oranges. You want oranges? No. You want pineapples? Don't have those. I'll go to the next guy.
Yeah.
I'll go to the next guy who might want an orange.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so that's just, you're just selling fruit.
Absolutely. And I used to say, okay, well, I'd have an audition. You know, whenever you're in Heldon Tenor, there aren't that many, you know, openings for Tannhäuser every year. you've got, if you're doing a good job, you've probably got maybe like, let's say a really good year, you sing five times, trying to get a Tannhäuser, and you need a Tannhäuser really bad. And so there's a lot of pressure on those auditions. I'll do an audition like that. And if it's a no, and often a no, even though I'm the best person there, not always, but that also does happen. You got to get used to it.
Sure.
Fall off that horse and sit there and whine or cry or whatever. I would do it for 5 days or 6 days. Mm. And my point was, you're never going to not fall off the horse, but can you get that 5 days whittled down to one day?
Right.
Okay. You've got one day of mourning and then that's it.
Right.
And that was a way, my way of giving it parameters and dealing with it.
Well, everybody's got to find their own path on that. But, well, my friend, thank you so much for joining us today. What a joy. I think I know you a little bit better than I did before, and we're only going to keep moving forward. So I wish you a blessed day, my friend. And
you too.
If you're going to the monks, you know, drop a little prayer for the old man on this end. And thanks for joining us today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for asking me. It's a real pleasure to talk about this stuff. Yeah. Have a great day.
We'll do more. You too. Thanks for joining us here at the Recovering Artist Podcast. We'd love for you to keep listening down the road. A special thanks to my amazing nephew, Tyler Anthony, for our theme song, What Do You Think? Written by Tyler of the band Sirius Bright. You can find it and other Sirius Bright tunes wherever you listen to music. Thanks to my producer and friend, Matt Haas Queen, for his tireless efforts to keep me on point. I appreciate you, my brother. And to you, the listeners. Without you, it would just be the community in my head, truly talking nonstop. Don't forget to drop us a note at our Facebook page, The Recovering Artist Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. See you soon, my friends, and remember, let go of the puzzles you can't solve. Only step by step, stage by stage, can you travel the road to greater knowledge and understanding. Have a great day.
Have we done wrong?
gone. What the hell have we done wrong? We're still here fighting your war, even when you are gone. What the hell have we done? Still on my clothes, what?